Well, thanks very much, and thanks so much for coming out. Is anybody from Potomac here? Because I feel like I should also add to the list that I was a member of Winston Churchill's High School's national championship team of three for the OSMI, and I think 1988 with Kenny Young, and I forgot him, maybe Lewis Calico. I forgot who the other guy was. So I just had to shout out for Churchill there, because I know there's some people in the Whitman district in the audience. And I'm not going to talk about arithmetic geometry tonight, although I do love talking about that. I'm going to talk about a story that's from the book, a story that I actually learned about in the course of writing a book, which I think in some sense typifies, or I hope does, the way that rather simple mathematical ideas can actually branch out and have rather broad application and connect to a rather surprising surprising set of things. And the story starts right here. So this was going to be a movie, but it's going to be a still picture. It's okay because, as you know, not much happens in a lottery drawing. There's not very much to see. You can imagine that wheel spinning and balls with numbers on them falling out of it. Everybody imagining it? Good. The only thing I really can't reproduce is the like awesome kind of comedy Boston accent with which the lottery officials like announce the numbers. That's really why I like showing the movie when I'm not in Boston. But this is a picture. So this is a picture of the drawing for the Massachusetts Lottery's game Cash Windfall from January 5th, 2012. For some reason, all of these drawings are on YouTube. You can go look at it yourself. And this particular one was the last ever drawing for the Cash Windfall game, and really the point of the talk is to talk about why that is. So I'm going to start. We're going to start with a little bit of math. So what I want to talk about is the mathematical notion of expected value, which is critical to sort of the way we think about lotteries. So here's a typical, this is a sort of baby example of a lottery. Let's say a ticket costs $2, and like most lotteries, it's based on having a small chance of winning a large prize. In this case, a $300 prize, which you have a 1 in 200 chance of winning. So some people play the lottery once, but most people play the lottery more than once. Most people who play the lottery a lot, actually. So let's imagine that you play this game 1,000 times. Well, if you have a 1 in 200 chance of your ticket being a winner, you'll probably win about 5 times. I mean, not definitely exactly that many, but that's about what you should expect. So overall, you would win that jackpot 5 times, which is $1,500, or $1.50 per ticket, right? That's your return per ticket that you have. So this kind of computation is exactly what we call expected value. And maybe what I want to sort of stop and say here is that this is one of those moments, which is unfortunately common, where mathematical English kind of diverges from the English that we normally speak. Because you might think that when we talk about the expected value, we would think that would be the value that you would expect the lottery ticket to have. Reasonable, right? But completely wrong. Because $1.50 is not even a possible value for the ticket to have. I mean, the ticket is either worth $0 or it's worth $300. Nothing in between. So if we could go back to the dawn of mathematical nomenclature and change things around, we would probably call this something more like average value. Because I think that's really a better way of thinking of what this notion is supposed to represent. It's supposed to think of the average value of a lot of randomly selected tickets. And why is this an interesting notion? Why is this what we want to compute? Because it really kind of gives you a good clue as to what's going to happen if you, as most lottery players do, play this game for a long time, which is that you're going to lose. On average, in fact, you're going to spend exactly $2 per ticket, and on average, you're going to get back $1.50 per ticket, so you may win some days and lose some days, but in the long run, you're going to be down about 50 cents a play. And a lot of lotteries are kind of like this. And there's a reason that they're kind of like this. The reason is that on every bet, there's somebody on one side and on somebody on the other side. And in a lottery, who's on the other side? The state. Even if I only play once, the state plays lots of times. And if I, on average, or I and all my fellow lottery players, are on average losing 50 cents a ticket, the state is gaining 50 cents a ticket. And that, of course, is the point. The lottery is a way for states to make money and then spend it on things like police and schools and roads and salaries of math professors in public universities that are critical for the effective functioning of the state. The function is not to give away money to the players. So let me show you, I'm going to show you sort of a typical, so it's not so important exactly what these numbers are, but I want you to see them. This is what the prize structure for cash windfall usually looked like. So the example I gave was sort of a very small example where there was just one kind of prize, but real lotteries are not like that. Real lotteries have tiers of prizes where there's a very big jackpot, which you're incredibly unlikely to win, and then a row of smaller prizes, which you have a little bit of a better chance to win. And the reason that is because people get depressed if they never win, and you want to keep people coming back. So this is sort of a typical structure. The six balls would come out of that cage that I showed you on the first slide. If you matched all six, great, you win a giant jackpot, however much is in the pool. That's actually variable. But if you have four of the right numbers, you already get like a pretty decent chunk of money, $150. And that's something that has about a 1 in 800 chance of happening. And the way you compute the expected value of such a ticket, and I've written it kind of small on the bottom there, is that you multiply each possible jackpot by the probability of getting that amount. So just like before, we had a 1 in 100... Well, I already forgot what the jackpot was. We had a 1 in 200 chance of getting a $300 prize, so the value was $300 divided by 200, or $1.50. Here, each of these prizes makes a contribution, and when you add it up, you get that the value of a cash windfall ticket was just a little bit under 80 cents. And a cash windfall ticket costs $2. So that should tell you about the advisability in the long run of playing this game. So people noticed that. People noticed it wasn't a great game, and Massachusetts found that people were not really playing their game. And then the state doesn't make money, right, if no one plays. So Massachusetts changed their rules. They introduced a new version of this game called Cash Windfall. They got the idea from a similar game in Michigan. And this game had kind of a cool feature. It was that when the jackpot got too big, it rolled down. Let me show you how this works on the next slide. If the jackpot passed a certain threshold, which in Massachusetts was $2 million, in the next drawing, if nobody won the jackpot, that money didn't just stay in the jackpot pool and make the jackpot bigger and bigger. The jackpot actually wasn't allowed to get big. All that money would roll down into the hit 5, hit 4, hit 3 prizes and make those prizes much better for that particular drawing. And their idea was that this would make the game more appealing. It would make it seem more like it was a good idea to play. And Massachusetts did its job very effectively, a little too effectively, so effectively that they inadvertently actually created a game that was a good idea to play. So here's how the cash windfall payoffs looked on February 7th, 2005. So remember, hitting 4 out of 6 used to get you, on a normal day, gives you $150. On this particular day, because there was a jackpot just over $2 million and nobody won it, that same outcome would get you $2,385, so a massively larger prize. And it turns out that on this day, the expected value of your $2 ticket was actually about $5.50. So that's a pretty great rate of return. I mean, that's a day when, on that day, it's probably actually a good idea to play Massachusetts Cash Windfall. So why do I know, by the way, why do I know the exact payoffs for this particular day, February 7th, 2005? Well, the reason I know that is because of this document, which you cannot read from here, but I just want to show you a very official-looking document with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts seal on it. This is a report from the Inspector General of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to the state treasurer trying to explain just what had happened with their lottery game and telling this rather incredible story, which I found out about. I would have to say this has got to be the only fiscal oversight document written by a state regulatory official, which makes you wonder if somebody has the movie rights to it. I mean, ever. It's really quite a remarkable document. So I recommend like going and looking up the PDF and like reading this thing. It's So what happened? The payoff structure of this lottery was not a secret. It was like published. Anybody could look at it. Anybody who could compute expected value could kind of figure out how this was going to go. There happened to be a guy at MIT, a senior at MIT named James Harvey, and he happens to be doing an independent study project on lottery games and their expected value in the spring of 2005. And it turned out that was a very fortunate time to be doing that project. Because when he looked at this new game in Massachusetts, he noticed he made the exact same table that I just showed you. And he called a bunch of his friends. And he said, how much money can you get together on short notice to buy lottery tickets? And pretty soon, these guys were buying thousands and tens of thousands of tickets every time it was a roll-down day. And they were not alone. Let me sort of show you who was in on this.
How did you know if it was a roll-down day?
Because every time the jackpot went above $2 million, it rolled down. And they would announce, what's the jackpot next week? So they would know. There's a good story about this, too. Am I going to tell this part of the story? We'll see. Hey, do you guys want me to stop when I was going to stop, or do you guys want me to stop 10 minutes after when I was going to stop because we started 10 minutes late? Okay. Because the fate of whether I tell this crazy story about the roll down depends on this. Okay. Anyway, who are the players? There's a group called Random Strategies. Even what they were doing was not very random, but they all lived in Random Hall, which is the name of a dorm at MIT. So James Harvey and Yuron Liu were the two main players here. Another guy was Jerry Selby. He was a retired guy with a degree in engineering from Michigan. I mentioned Michigan once before in this talk. Do you guys remember why? So this guy had been doing the same thing in Michigan until they shut the game down there. And then one day he like reads in the newspaper, he's like, okay, well, it's all over. And then one day he reads in the newspaper that Massachusetts has opened the same game. He's like, what? I can't believe it. And he got in the car with his wife, and they drove to Deerfield, Massachusetts, in the corner of the state, which is sort of the closest point in Massachusetts to Michigan, and like bought lots of tickets and made lots of money. And so he immediately got his family members like back on the gravy train that they thought was gone for good for Michigan and started playing this game in Massachusetts. And then there was the Dr. Jong Lottery Club, which was run by a guy called Ying Zhang, who was a biomedical guy, who were buying lots of tickets down in Quincy, Massachusetts. So these three groups, after a certain amount of time, were buying, each one of them was buying hundreds of thousands of tickets every roll-down day. And it came to the point where actually, they estimate about 80 to 90% of all the tickets bought in this game were being bought by members of these three betting cartels. So I'll just comment. So what happens at this point? I mean, it's great to put it, buy a $2 ticket and make $5.50 on average. But the more tickets that are bought, the greater extent to which any given combination of four numbers is going to be actually purchased by more than one of these people. So the prizes start to split, and the expected value of the ticket goes down. So there's sort of a very interesting game theory problem here where... Because you might say, well, why didn't more people do this? And the answer is, above a certain threshold of tickets bought, the game stops being positive expected value. So these guys got to the point where actually they were taking home about 10 to 15% profit on average. Once all these guys were in and buying tons and tons and tons of tickets, that sort of they were still making a sort of reliable income, but it wasn't the sort of incredible cash flow that they had at the very beginning when people sort of hadn't caught on to how this is going to work. Okay, so maybe I will tell this story of what happened on August 13th, 2010. So by this point, this has been going on for about 5 years. And all these guys are like trying to figure out like, how can we gotta get back to the good old days when this was easy? On August 15th, 2010, the projected jackpot is $1.7 million. That's what the announced jackpot is. So it's not a roll down day, right? So on this day, and this is like the best part of this general's report, the MIT guys buy 700,000 tickets instead of their usual 200,000. They buy so many tickets that by themselves, they push the entire lottery over the roll-down threshold. They put so much money into the jackpot pool, and then they're basically just like standing in front of the faucet alone. So on that day, they bought 90% of all the tickets were just them. So they got together, you know, $1.4 million. I mean, they'd been winning a lot, so they had it. And they made $700,000 of profit in a single day. They put in $1.4 million and got 2.1. So this was a very daring move. And there's kind of an exciting thing in the report where they're like, there's all these calls going back and forth, like in the state lottery, like they're trying to make it roll, they're trying to make it roll. It was very exciting. And they're very proud. They tried it again, actually, on Christmas. They thought the lottery officials like wouldn't be watching on Christmas, but then they sort of rechanged the projection. They had somebody there on Christmas to update the projection, and then the other guys got in, so it didn't work the second time. Say again. Well, no, because what happens if all the other guys play, they don't lose. It just means that they're at their kind of not as exciting 10% profit range. This is a sort of small digression, but I'll just comment on sort of where some of these ideas come from. So this is in the... The way this is set up, it's actually like rather subtle, and it took me a long time to kind of truly feel like I understand like where all the money was flowing. But what it comes down to is that for these guys, it's better if fewer people play, because there's money that's already in the jackpot, and they're taking a higher share of it. So who are these guys? Anybody know, by the way? Good. Okay, Voltaire's on the left. Who's the other guy? The other guy's the math guy. I thought you guys would know the other guy. That's Pascal, exactly. So we have Voltaire and Pascal. In the book, I say a lot more of them. I'm just going to sort of mention them here. To say Voltaire, another thing I learned is that, I mean, there have been lottery schemes throughout history. And I found out that another badly designed lottery actually took place in France in the 18th century. And a friend of Voltaire liked mathematics. And he had a lot of friends and lovers who were mathematicians. He sort of traveled in those circles. And one of his friends came to him one day and was like, you know, France has designed this lottery really badly, and we can make a lot of money. and so his friend, the Marquis de Condamine of Voltaire, this was actually how Voltaire made his fortune. I never knew this. I always thought that, like, writing witty essays paid better in old-time France than it did today. But it's not true. He became a man of leisure by means of this lottery scheme that he participated in with the Marquis de Condamine. I put Pascal up here because he, together with Fermat, is one of the guys who really develops probability theory and the theory of expected value. And most famously, you know, he sort of starts out a brilliant mathematician and stays a brilliant mathematician, but also kind of becomes a religious mystic and becomes much more interested in religious mysticism than he is in mathematics, like at the end of his life. In fact, there's these very kind of poignant letter exchanges with Fermat, where Fermat's like, oh, I'm going to be like in your town. Can we like come and talk math? And he's like, I love you. I love talking math with you, but I'm just not into it anymore. Like, we're not going to do it. It's quite moving, actually. But in some sense, the most famous expected value calculation Pascal ever did was the famous Pascal's wager, when he sort of tried to treat the idea of belief in God as a bet that you might make, which... reasoning that if you bet on God and you were right, the payoff was very large. And if you bet against God and you were wrong, the negative payoff was very bad. And this is sort of a famous argument which Voltaire kind of vehemently rejected. And so in the book, I talk a lot about the interesting interplay between these two men with their very different approaches to mathematics and their very different personalities, which I tried to illustrate by my choice of picture. Voltaire was kind of had a rather sunny outlook, and Pascal was kind of a gloomy nerd, I would say, in modern language. But that's all the French I'm going to say in this talk. So, okay, here's the end of Cash Windfall. This is a front page story from the Boston Globe in the summer of 2011, where Andrea Estes and Scott Allen broke this story, explained more or less what was going on in the lottery. And now the game is up, right? Because if everyone knows that this is what's happening, the whole project of making the game seem like a good play does not seem so good, and everybody stops playing, and Massachusetts shuts the game down. So this is kind of the end of the story as a narrative, but it's not the end of the story as we think about it mathematically, because I think that the story as I've told it leaves quite a few puzzles, of which I'm going to talk about two. So puzzle one is, how did they get away with this? Like, how did Massachusetts not figure out this was happening, right? I mean, they know who's winning the lottery. They're like, huh, what do you know? Like, 10,000 guys won the pick four at this Star Market by MIT. Like, again. So you might say it's very strange. And this goes on. This is, if you notice the dates, this is going on for 7 years, right, from 2005 until 2011. So this is very strange, right? France, there was, like, no phones, no computers. There's an excuse, but... But here, what's going on? And this puzzle, I'm going to talk about two puzzles, one with a simple answer, one with a complicated answer. This one has a simple answer. The simple answer is that the state did figure it out, and Massachusetts knew, essentially from the very beginning, exactly what was going on. And we know this because James Harvey, before he placed his very first bet, went out to Braintree and went to the lottery headquarters and was like, hey, like, your lottery is very poorly designed, and I'm about to buy a lot of tickets and make a lot of money. Is that legal? Because... Because you guys know, like, kids who, like, go to, like, fancy colleges are, like, very rule-abiding types, right, who don't like to. So that's what he did, and it is not recorded what response he got, but I think we can safely assume was something like, sure, knock yourself out. Because, you know, the week after that was when he and his Confederates, like, placed their first bets. Well, but, okay, if that were the case, immediately afterwards when they saw the same convenience stores in Quincy, Mass. For Dr. Jong, in Cambridge for MIT, and in Deerfield for the Selbys, winning thousands of wins at a time, I mean, they knew. They knew. They wouldn't tell me they knew, but they knew. I called Michigan. They said they didn't know. They knew, too. Okay, but there is sort of a sub-puzzle to this puzzle, right, which is that why then didn't they do anything about it? Like, why did they allow this to go on? So to understand this, it takes a moment of thinking about how the lottery really works. So I have a very advanced diagram on the next page demonstrating how a lottery works. You see, the way the lottery works is that Massachusetts sells tickets for $2 each. And for each $2 tickets that's sold, that's $2 coming into Massachusetts. Massachusetts keeps 80 cents. And that's what pays, that's the money that the state keeps to pay for its stuff. And the other $1.20 is going to go out in prizes. And that makes computations about the lottery, from the state's point of view, extremely simple, because the state's take is 80 cents per ticket sold, period. The state does not care who wins. The state only cares how many tickets are sold. So if these guys come and we're like, we're going to make your lottery a lot bigger by buying hundreds of thousands of extra tickets, that is great for the state. So the Inspector General estimates that the state, over the course of this whole thing, due to the actions of these three large betting cartels, took in $120 million of extra revenue over the course of the scheme. So I think it's safe to say that somehow, if you come away with $120 million, you're not the one who got scammed. So I think this is sort of portrayed as like these guys scammed the state, but that's not true. Oh, so this is an interesting story. I forgot if I have this on a slide, so maybe I'll just tell it, and if I have it on a slide, we'll see it. But if your source of income is playing the lottery, your taxes are super, super annoying to do. Because each win requires a separate form, which if I remember right is called a W-2G. And so they had to. So these guys definitely had to spend a lot of time filling out thousands of forms. What's more, no, that's not the end. You have to be able to... You have to count your losses against your wins, right? So you don't just like keep the 1 in 1,000 tickets that's a winner and fill out a form. You have to keep the losing tickets too, in case you get audited, so that you can prove that you lost. So Jerry Selby told me that he bought a barn, and the barn is filled with like all the losing tickets that he accumulated in Michigan and Massachusetts. He has a barn full of them in case he gets audited by the IRS. Because if he didn't have them, he claimed all these gambling losses on his taxes. He would be completely screwed. Okay. Anyway, back to my sophisticated diagram. So who are they taking this money from, if not from the state of Massachusetts? They were taking money from the other players, the players who were playing the game when it was not a roll-down day. We were playing it like a normal lottery. So that's really the arrow shows, like, where is money flowing? And then each time some money flows, Massachusetts takes a piece. And the fatter that arrow is, the more money that's flowing, the more that's happening, the more money Massachusetts makes. So it's actually quite an interesting, I think it's actually quite an interesting moral question, one which the Inspector General does not really address. Nobody really was getting fooled, in some sense. The structure of the lottery, you may say, but all those regular players like lost a lot of money to the cartels, but they would have lost a lot of money if they played a regular lottery, too. I'm not going to address the moral question. I'm just going to like raise it and let it sit. But I'll just comment that structurally, there's another gambling apparatus that looks a lot like this. You see, what is random strategies doing? Regular lottery players, they're playing occasionally. They're making small bets. Sometimes they win. Sometimes they lose. Random strategies are making lots and lots and lots of bets, so many that the risk kind of evens out. And even if they lose some bets and win some bets, overall, they're coming out ahead in a fairly reliable way and making a profit each time. So people talk about how do these guys beat the house, but this is a big mistake. They were the house, right? That's what the house does. Like what I just described is the house's play. So I think structurally, this is quite similar to the following sophisticated diagram. You should think of random strategies as being the casino and the regular lottery players as the regular guys who go to the casino and sometimes lose and sometimes win, but lose slightly more often than they win, so that the casino, on the whole, has a fairly regular money supply. And what role does the state play? Well, the state is the state. I mean, states don't like to gamble. States like to collect taxes. That's what states are good at. And that's exactly what Massachusetts was doing, taking an absolutely predictable cut with no chance involved on each transaction that took place between the, so to speak, casino players and the house. And I think that's the right way to, in the end, to see what happened in the cash windfall story, that Massachusetts was no more being ripped off by random strategies than Nevada is being ripped off because there's a lot of casinos there. Nevada is delighted to have them there, as you probably know. Okay, so that's one puzzle, and I think the solution, I think I've given a satisfying solution to it. Here's the second puzzle. Jerry Selby and Dr. Jong used what's called a quick pick machine. I don't know if you guys know. Who here plays the lottery a lot? A lot of liars in the room tonight. Okay. I know you all know what a quick pick machine is, but I'm going to tell you anyway. A quick pick machine is a machine that will print out random tickets for you, right? You just choose your tickets at random. Jerry Selby and Dr. Jong bought their tickets in this way. Random strategies did not. They filled out their tickets by hand, 200,000 tickets. They bubbled in the numbers by hand. This is a puzzle. Why did they do this? This takes a lot of time and is incredibly tedious on top of the other kinds of tedium I already told you about. After all, the expected value of a ticket is the same no matter which ticket it is. Your average rate of return per play should be just the same whether you buy the tickets by quick pick or whether you fill them out yourself. And when I say should be, I mean it is. I mean, this is a mathematical fact. So why would they do this? And to explain this, sometimes in math, you know, when you're trying to explain something, the best way to do it is to replace the problem you're studying with a smaller or easier one, which has the same features, but somehow you can hold it in your head all at once. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to sort of remove ourselves from this actual cash windfall lottery and talk about a game that sometimes, for reasons I was not able to divine, called the Transylvanian lottery. Here's how the Transylvanian lottery works. So here's a picture of all the possible tickets. There are seven numbers instead of 46 as there were in cash windfall, and the lottery only picks three instead of picking six. So a lottery ticket has three numbers drawn from 1 through 7, and I've written here all 35 possible tickets. These are all 35 ways to choose three numbers out of seven. So for fans of the binomial theorem, you would call this number 7 choose 3. That's what 35 is in this case. And how does the prize structure work in this kind of simple version of this game? Maybe I'll write this on the board so we can look at it. This is not good. So all three numbers, if you get all three numbers right, just like in any lottery, you win the jackpot. And if you get 2 out of 3 right, you get a prize. Let's call it a deuce. to remember to recall, remind us of the number 2. So this kind of has the features of the lottery that there's like a big prize and then a bunch of smaller prizes that you might try to get. So for instance, just to see how this works, let's say that the winning number is 137. Okay, so if I have 137, I get the jackpot. If I have 127, I have the 1 and 7 right, so I get a deuce, but I don't get the jackpot. And if I have 145, I'm going to have one number right, but you don't get anything for that. So that's how this lottery works. So in this rather small lottery, maybe you can imagine a big-time player being somebody who buys 7 tickets at once. Right? You don't have to buy. There's only 35 tickets in all. So let's say you buy 7. And let's say you buy them with Quick Pick. You just have the Quick Pick give you 7 random tickets. And, you know, they could be anything. Each one is chosen independently. Like, you could have 2 that are the same. I mean, all kinds of things could happen. And I made a little chart to show you some of the probabilities with your 7 random tickets. And just to sort of make these tables smaller, I'm not going to sort of talk about the jackpots as much as I talk about the deuces. It looks like most likely is you're going to get about 2 or 3 deuces. In fact, the expected number of deuces, in the sense that I said at the beginning, turns out to be, if I remember right, 2.4. So it's not so surprising that 2 or 3 are the 2 most common things to get. But you could get totally shut out. It's not that likely. Or you could, like, really make out great and get... It could be that all 7 of your things are deuces. That's only a 1 in 1,000 chance, but it could happen. So what I'm going to do is tell you about a different way to pick your tickets. And I have it on a slide, so let's look at it. So here's my 7 tickets that I'm going to buy. Okay, here's another set of 7 tickets. And now, maybe I need a little bit of audience participation. What? Well, the question is, I just need somebody to be the lottery for me and like shout out a randomly chosen set of 3 numbers. 257. Okay, let's see how I do. So, 257. Okay, I don't see that on my list, so I didn't win a jackpot. On the other hand, I do have a 2 and a 7, right? I have there's a deuce right there. 247 is a deuce. I also have 256, so I got a deuce. 357. Okay. So I've got 3 deuces. Okay, and we should check. There's no more, but I think there are no more. I think that's it. Do we agree? No more. Okay, somebody, and I need another random number. 641. Okay, 641, which I'll write as 146, but it doesn't matter in this game. It's just easier for me to like pattern recognize if I write them in order. Okay.
777.
Because that's not the way. So this is like in the. I think in most lotteries they draw without replacement, right?
I don't. Okay.
You know, my father, who used to be the president of the American Statistical Association, plays the Powerball every time it gets big. So don't get all high and mighty about it. Not playing it. I'm not sure I was authorized to reveal that, but it's... Anyway, 146, can we find the deuces here? So 145, I've got 1. 167.
346,
any more?
No,
I've got 3, okay. Okay, I want one more. Let's do one more.
257.
Wait, we already did 257. I could do that, but it would not demonstrate the desired effect. 462, okay, which I'll write as 246, but it's the same. Okay, so that's kind of similar to 146, and so one of the deuces, 346, is still a deuce. I've got 247, and I've got 256, and that's it, right? So there's 3. Wait, so we agree there's 3, right? Okay. So, okay, who sees the pattern? Okay, so this is not by chance. This set of numbers was not chosen by Quick Pick. This set of numbers was chosen by me to do something. And let me now show you how I chose it. I chose it like this. So this is a very beautiful picture. It's a picture of something called the Fano plane. Developed by the Italian geometer Giuseppe Fano around the end of the 19th century. This looks like a picture of 7 dots with some curves between them. But a modern person would say this is a picture of the plane. And these little segments I've drawn, some of them looks like line segments, and one of them looks like a circle. But again, to a modern person, we would say they are lines. So why would we say that? Well, first of all, before I actually talk about this, let me just show you. I want to show you the equivalent table, just to sort of show you that I'm not kidding about this. Using my set of tickets, the table looks extremely different. Depending on the random numbers chosen by the lottery, there's an 80% chance that this happens, and I get three deuces. And it turns out that the only way that that can fail to happen is if I actually hit the jackpot. So this set of tickets has the remarkable feature that you basically can't lose. You have a guaranteed payoff. To some extent, you sacrifice some of the chance of getting a really big payoff, but you completely eliminate the chance of losing money. And this is actually of critical importance, because if your play is that you have a bunch of friends in college, and you're like, I want all of you guys to like loan me all the money you have, and I'm going to buy lottery tickets with it, and you lose, and then you say, but mathematically speaking, on average, we're going to come out ahead in the long run. This is not such a winning play, so for sort of extra mathematical reasons. So it's actually critically important to find ways. You see, the expected value does not depend on which tickets you pick, but the risk does. Or another way to put it is the variance of your winnings does depend. And so most people, given a choice between two plays with the same expected value, will choose the one that gives them less risk, will choose the one that has a smaller variance of outcomes. And that's exactly what you get by choosing your numbers carefully, by not using the quick pick and making a careful choice. So let me say a little bit. Now we're sort of near the end, but I want to say a little bit about why this works. Why is it that no matter what three numbers the person picks, I have a deuce? Well, I'm going to actually go back instead of forward and just say another word about this picture. I told you that in my mind, these things are points. I drew them as little dots. And the curves I drew are lines. What on earth gives me the right to say that, especially this one, which looks like a circle? Well, in our modern way of thinking about mathematics, the axiomatic way, which it's sort of associated with David Hilbert, and I write a lot about Hilbert in the book, but it's older than that, and it's certainly as old as Fano, who is writing here about axiomatic geometry. What is a point? A point is a thing that behaves like a point. What is a line? A line is a thing that behaves like a line. Okay, that seems very circular. Exactly. So what do I mean by that? In this case, the property that these things have is that any two lines intersect at a single point. If I look at any of these, there are seven of them if you count. If you look at any of these lines, like for some reason I can't see the numbers. They're down here. I don't know quite how that happened. Like the lines 1, 2, 3 and 1, 4, 5 intersect here at 1. So I'm whereas the line 2, 5, 6, which is the one that looks like a circle, and 1, 6, 7 intersect just at this point. And similarly, through any two of these points, there's exactly one line, just like geometry should behave. And so in the modern approach, we sort of call anything a geometry, any collection of things called points and things have lines, which obey these axioms, which are as old as the hills, or at least as old as Euclid, that through any two points, there's exactly one line, and any two lines intersect at exactly one point. Those are not quite the familiar axioms for plane geometry for a reason I will leave as an exercise for the plane geometry fans. So you see, what happens if, let's take this example, 257. How did I know I was going to win three deuces? Well, I would need to know how many tickets I have that have a 2 and a 5. Well, here's 2, and here's 5. And if the line segments of my ticket, there is exactly one line through those two points, namely 2, 5, 6. So that's a ticket I have. What about 2 and 7? There's exactly one line through 2 and 7, namely the line 2, 4, 7, which is a ticket I have. And there's exactly one line through 5 and 7, namely this is 3, 5, 7, and that's a ticket I have. So the axioms of the geometry that this Fano plane obeys precisely guarantee that this set of tickets will have this magical property that no matter what I do, either I get a jackpot, that's when the three numbers chosen by the lottery are actually collinear, or I get exactly three deuces, one for each pair of numbers. So it would be great if I had a picture as beautiful as this that works for the cash windfall, which has 6 numbers chosen out of 46 instead of this rather small 3 numbers out of 7. I don't, but there's a whole beautiful, rich theory called the theory of combinatorial designs that exactly exists to find various constellations of subsets of this many of this kind of thing that have properties sort of like this. So maybe I should say, I found James Harvey. What do you think he's doing? Anybody want to guess? No? Good guess, but no? That's close enough. Silicon Valley startup dude. Okay. Anyway, I found him. And I like that, by the way, on his like CV, he lists his interests. He lists non-traditional investment strategies. I like that. I thought that was very... I thought that was very well put. Anyway, I sort of started to figure out something like this was going on. I was like, okay, so come on, what did you guys do? Like, what was the... I assume that your choice of the numbers was some kind of variance minimizing strategy, but what was it? He wouldn't tell me. He was like, well, we had this guy. We had, like, a math guy, and he did it. Clearly didn't want to say anymore. So I became kind of obsessed, and I was like, I'm going to figure this out myself if this guy won't tell me. So I went through the literature on combinatorial designs, and I found a beautiful paper from 1976 by a fellow named R.A. Denniston, who is from England, who found a very beautiful, what's called a Steiner system. And using the thing in this paper, I was able to cook up a set of about 220,000 tickets, which, when you look at the 5 out of 6 prizes, which is a lot of where a lot of the money was coming in on a roll-down day, it basically meant that you were almost guaranteed to win 6 of those, which already is enough to guarantee that you would not lose. There was about a 3/4 chance of winning all, of winning 6 of them, and almost all of the rest of the probability was in winning 5 out of the 6, and you were guaranteed to win at least 4. So I was able to put together something which I would say, if they weren't doing this, I think they should have done this. it's at least as good as what they did, because by choosing the tickets carefully at the expense of having to spend a lot of time filling out these ovals on a piece of paper, you can guarantee that you won't lose your friend's money. So that's what I have to say, and I'm just going to... So I have to show a picture of my book, but today I don't have to, because you can look at the real thing. So compare the picture and the real thing. Thanks very much.